Mr. Brown, Rail 11. Right, Mr. Brown, we're still talking about the move to Austria, and you were in this billet. We're talking about the fraternisation policy. What was the attitude of the people in the battalion towards the local civilian population?
Friendly, I would say.
Because for 6 years, they've been part of the enemy. Was there anybody?
Yeah, well, it's funny that, I think we weren't coming into contact so much with men. You know, the men wouldn't be around so much, so we were coming into contact, certainly as far as I was concerned, with women and children. And the animosity just wasn't there somehow.
About how long was it before the non-fraternisation policy was lifted?
I couldn't say.
It was lifted at some
point. It was lifted, but I couldn't remember.
So what were your duties in this place? What were you doing in Bruckel? What was a day in Bruckel?
Day in Bruckel was, I don't know, much like any other day. We seem to have quite a fair amount of spare time, actually, as I remember that's when we started playing company cricket teams. We started to have a company cricket team. We had, of course, the wireless, office, signals office, and the usual exchange set up, and putting calls through from one company to another, or from brigade to headquarters, and you had your days on duty in the signals office, and obviously you were putting lines out and things like that. But I remember there was a canal running through which turned a mill wheel. There was a mill there, and you could swim in the canal. I remember afternoons swimming in the canal and playing football and playing cricket, but not anything great in the way of training. But when we first got there, of course, the situation was fluid as regard all the refugees and things and the Yugoslavs milling around. You could walk out in the fields and you'd find a field full of weapons. You know, everybody was walking around picking up a nice revolver, and it was amazing that there should be so much litter lying about in that fashion.
So were people actively seeking out kind of collector's items amongst this stuff?
Well, there were. I know I picked up a revolver and thought, well, I'll keep that, but I didn't in the end. Got rid of it. Well, I think there was all the fear that if you try to take weapons like that back into England, you know, you might be caught coming back into England, and we were warned against it, of course, so that I certainly didn't. I don't think any of my closest associates did either.
Now, you mentioned the refugees. You say they were mainly Yugoslavians at this point. So what were they trying to do? Were they trying to get back home? Or
yeah, they were trying to mill back into Austria over the border.
And what about returning German servicemen? Were there any of those around?
There had been some around. There were some around. I think they were just moved on, as far as I remember.
And what about, the so-called kind of, denazification? Was the battalion involved at all in, trying to round up, the local
Nazis
officials?
I wasn't involved, if there were.
Anything else about Bruckel that sticks in your mind?
No, I think that's about all. Fields of weapons, but, really, life being much easier than it had been.
Now, what about, you're in Austria, the war had ended, it was, coming in the spring, summer 45. Was it easier to keep in touch with people at home, and was the mail still censored, or had that stopped?
I can't remember if it was censored there, whether that stopped, to be honest. I know it was straightforward with me in those days. you just sent letters off when you wanted and, you know, got them quite regularly. The one thing I remember about Bruckel and Austria in general, when we went there from Italy, was that how beautiful it was. It was clean, green, refreshing somehow. It seemed to sparkle to me after Italy, and I really fell in love with Austria. I thought it was a marvellous place.
And so the area where you were at wasn't touched by the war? There was no damage built?
No.
So after Bruckel, what happened then?
I'm not sure whether we went to Vienna next or Vildon next. Vildon was a little place near Graz where we went to, but we also spent some time in Vienna because at that time was tripartite, as you know, and you had to go to Vienna to do your spells, guard duties and so on.
Well, we'll talk about that. If you could talk about the Vildon experience first. Then we'll talk about Vienna. So what do you think about that?
Well, Vildon, we were billeted, I remember, in the main street, as it were, in a building. And I don't remember much about everyday life, except that at that time the battalion football team was involved in a competition, I think a brigade competition, playing other battalions, etc., units round about. And we were taken into the woods, as it were, and we were billeted separately from headquarters company. And we used to work in the forests in the morning, stacking these lengths of wood, about a yard long, stacking them up in the forest, presumably getting ready for the winter coming on. And in the afternoon, we'd be training for football. So we got extra rations and we had a good time all around.
What did the non-footballers think about?
About that? I don't know if they even realised. I mean, about what, 15 people maybe, you know, a football team, a few reserves, and I don't suppose many people realised much.
Now, during your period in Italy and so on, you were on combo rations for a lot of the time. What was the food situation like post-war in Austria?
Don't remember much about it.
So it would maybe the same as what it was in England, the same, standard army.
That's right, yeah.
And what else about the Vildon? What else about that period? Anything else?
Well, while we were at Vildon, unfortunately I was crocked, but they started a football team, British Troops in Austria, we were beginning to be known as, and the British Troops in Austria had a football team. And Jerry Best had gone, and I remember some officer saying there'd been a message through wanting me to go and join this football team, this British Troops in Austria football team. And I had a cropped ankle. I didn't want to leave the battalion, the friends I had round about. At that time, I didn't realise how soon the battalion would break up. If I had, I might have changed my mind, but I didn't want to go to this BTA and turn up and say, well, I'm here to play football, but I can't play because I've got a crocked ankle. And that weighed in my mind, and as I say, not wanting to leave the battalion, so I refused. And at times afterwards, I regretted it. I thought I had another year to spend abroad after that. I could have spent it quite happily if somebody had got cracking on the ankle and repaired it. And it did repair itself in due course. I would have been better off, possibly. But that's just one of those things.
Now, was it during this period that you were playing for the 46th Division team?
Yes. There were rumours that we were going to have a tour of Italy and play all the units still in Italy, and the 46th, they were going to take a divisional team down there, but that didn't come about either.
So if you'd have joined the British Troops Austria team, that would have, you would have effectively been a full-time footballer for the
army. It would, yeah.
Yeah,
no, that's what I say. Sometimes I regretted it.
So you were playing football. You were doing that. What else was occupying your time? Was there any kind of?
Well, the usual. I mean, there's bound to be a signal office set up, and you had to do that. But there didn't seem to be any training as such going on, no battalion exercises or anything that I can remember. And I really can't imagine now how we spent the days.
Was there anything? You're in the army, you're in Austria. Was there anything that you were short of that you could trade with the locals for? Was there kind of a black market in anything that you would swap British Army food or whatever for what you could get from the locals? Was there anything
not
like that going on?
Not in Vildon or Bruckel, but in Italy, for vino, you had cigarettes, and if you wanted your washing done, you know, you had to pay somehow to get your washing done. And in Vienna, there was a black market of cigarettes and so on.
Were those still in plentiful supply?
Cigarettes?
Yeah. You'd be trading those
For that.
Mm. So Vienna, you mentioned Vienna. Can you just talk about that?
Well, we were, I don't know, it was a school or a hall or something, but we were, you know, the usual signal office, and I didn't have to do any real guard duties or anything. As such, you know, the rifle battalions were doing that, the rifle companies were doing that. We were allowed to go into Vienna. The place wasn't really opened up yet, really for tourists, as you might say. But the opera house opened up, and I remember seeing a couple of operas there. Gay Rosalinda, I think, was one of them. That was that wasn't the German name, was it? Die Fledermaus. That's right, Die Fledermaus and Madame Butterfly. But the big castle and thing weren't open to the public at that stage, so we couldn't get into the castle there.
What kind of state did the Viennese civilians, what kind of state were they in?
Well, it didn't look too prosperous to me, but, you know, they didn't look unhealthy either. I can't remember seeing too many haggard faces. I don't think they were starving or really too underfed. Probably didn't have a lot of variety maybe in food, but they seemed to be all right.
Were they any more or less friendly than the civilians you'd met out in the country districts?
Well, I didn't really come into contact with them or talk to them a lot, so I wouldn't really know about that.
Now, you mentioned that there was like the four power agreement in Vienna, the different changes of the guard. Did you have any encounters with Russian soldiers just in your general day-to-day?
No, you'd see them on trams and undergrounds and around, but never had any contact with them.
How did they strike you and your friends?
Well, the ones I saw looked quite smart, funnily enough. Maybe they were just the officers who came around, I'm not sure, but they looked quite respectable and smart.
Now, during your period in Austria, apparently the battalion was involved at one point in rounding up a Cossack battalion that had...
Oh, that was in the early days when we would probably be at Bruckel.
Can you remember anything about that, how that transpired?
No, I just remember, you know, that it was happening, and these Russian Cossacks were, you know, being sent back to Russia.
And what was people's feelings about that at the time?
Well, we didn't know, of course, then what transpired later, so I don't think there were any any feelings one way or another. It was just another job to do.
Anything else about Vienna during the period there?
No, don't remember.
So you weren't involved in the changing of the guards?
No.
Did you watch any of the changes?
No, we must have been busy elsewhere, and no, I didn't see any.
Now, apparently, from Austria, you went on home leave.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just describe how that was organised and how men were selected or how they qualified for home leave?
Well, it was depending on how long you'd been abroad, so that quite a few of the people had gone before I went on home leave. Danny certainly did, and it just happened that your number came up and off you went.
So it was, and how, what was the period of being abroad?
Well, I'd been abroad then about 2 years and 2 months, something like that.
Now, I think you mentioned off the tape this phrase, LEAP.
Yes.
Could you just tell us what that means?
Well, that was the month's leave that you got, and it stood for leave in addition to Python. Python the snake. But Python was the period you served overseas before you were repatriated. And in my time, when I was repatriated, finally, it was 3 years and 3 months. Well, it was when I got LEAP. I don't know if it was different then. It could have been. Maybe the period was shortened as time went on. But that's what LEAP was, and you had a month's leave.
And you mentioned some of the, I suppose, some of the men that had been with the battalion longer than you. They'd had this leave. What kind of stories were they telling you about England? You know, you'd been away for over 2 years.
Mm.
You're in a foreign country still. You know, your friends, some of them had gone back, been away for a month, and they'd come back.
Yeah.
Were they telling you anything different about how England might have changed since over that 2 years? Was there any stories that come to mind before you actually
got back? Well, I mean, everybody said how marvellous it was, but Danny had been up to see Betty, my wife, while he was on leave, so he had a bit to tell me about that. I remember Captain Harris coming back, and if the platoon got together, and in Italy you got some vino, or you got a drink or two, you know, people would get up, it might have been like the modern karaoke, and everybody would have the song to sing, and they'd get up and sing the song. And I remember Captain Harris coming back and saying, "Oh my goodness, you know, you want to finish with all those old songs, you know, there's new songs about now." And he had one, I think it was, "If I had a paper doll to call my own, a paper doll." And he sang that, and there were odd stories like that coming back.
Was there any talk of kind of the austerity in England, because obviously you said there was still rationing and so
on? I think probably when people got home, they when, you know, the home crowd knew that their son or husband or whatever was coming home, they'd make a special effort. So we didn't come back. No stories came back about, you know, it being very, very hard to live or feed or anything in England at that time.
So you qualified for the LEAP. How did you get back to England?
I had to go to Villach, I think, to start with. And then we went over to Milan, and it was all train. And I remember being a couple of nights in Milan, and then on another train, and we went right through to the coast from Milan by train, over to Dover, I suppose, and then on.
And what was your first impressions of being back in England?
Just happy to be back.
And did you travel through London?
must have done to get a train north, but it would just be going from station to station, and I can't think that you know, I saw a lot of damage or had time to look around really.
And it was back to Jarrow.
Back to Jarrow, and then I got married. So that was on Boxing Day 1945. It was the only day we could arrange to get married in the short period of time we had. So we got married on Boxing Day because Betty was in the ATS. She was on ACAC batteries and various other things after the ACAC finished. And we thought, well, it'd be a good idea to get married because married women at that stage could get out of the ATS. They were demobbed. And she, of course, had a job to go back to in the library, as I had. And she could start building up a little fund of money for us.
Now, you got married. I think you mentioned off the tape you were in your uniform. Was that true? You married in your uniform?
Yeah, that's right.
What was the, I mean, other people have talked about the clothing situation at this period, you know, even after the war with rationing and so on.
Mm.
Was it difficult to have a, you know, a good formal wedding with, you know,
oh, yes.
The effort to do that with the bridesmaids and the whole thing? And
Oh, we had bridesmaids and, you know, it was a formal wedding, I suppose, in church, and a sort of get together afterwards in a sort of church hall. Well, I was quite happy and good.
Now, you still had quite a way to go in the army.
Mm.
Had the business of the numbers, the demob numbers, had those been issued by this point? Did you know?
I think they had by that point. I knew, I think I was number 48, which, you know, compared to the 24s and 25s among some of the old stagers, because it not only went by service in the army, it also went by age, I think, so that the older people were naturally demobbed before the younger people, even if they joined up at the same time.
Now, you got married. Had you given any thought to staying in the army?
No. My only thought was to get out of the army.
So there was no, that had never entered your mind?
Never.
What about your friends? Had anybody expressed an interest in maybe staying in?
No, I can't remember anybody saying, oh, I'm going to stay in the army, I'm not going to go back to Civvy Street.
So everybody was keen?
Everybody was keen, quite happy to be going home.
So you're married now, you're on your month's leave. Were you aware of the fact that your job, you know, was the job ready to go back to? I mean, was there, apparently there was some kind of rule enforced that
Well, we always knew that the job was being kept open, so that was no worry about that.
And so that was where you thought, this is where I'm going to be when I get out of the army?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You knew, well, I knew where I was going to be, yes.
So what did you feel at the end of this month's leave when you had to go?
Didn't want to go back. Just wanted to stay at home, naturally.
But you did go back?
Yes.
And what was the situation when you got back?
I think by that time it was beginning to be realised that we were breaking up. You know, we had to break up. And I don't know how long it would be. I'd get back to the battalion in Vildon, it would be, sometime in January, I suppose. And it didn't seem long after that before I was on another train going down to Taranto to join the 1st Battalion at Taranto, who were going to sail over to Greece.
We'll talk about that in due course, but at this stage, when the knowledge, when it became generally known that the battalion was going to disband, what did people feel about that?
Well, there was a certain amount of regret because, you know, you naturally hope that we've been together for, in my case, a couple of years, you'd be quite happy to remain in that environment until the time to go.
And apparently, during this period, the battalion had its own magazine. Do you remember much about that?
No, I think one of the signalers took over the job as deputy editor, but he was connected with it. A chap called King, I think it was Ronnie King. And he wrote some pieces and generally helped to oversee the production of it.
How would you describe the morale of the battalion at this stage? I mean, it's way towards the end of the battalion's life. You mentioned people were just raring to get home, back to civilian life.
Yeah.
Was there anybody that you knew that wanted to stay in the army?
No, I didn't. No. I'm trying to think about the only one I knew had been in the army a long time, Chalky White, one of the platoon. I can't remember if he was still there or not, but he might have been the only one who might have stayed, being in the army before. But certainly I didn't hear of anybody professing to stay in the army.
And the process of disbandment, that involved people being demobbed, I assume. And also people like yourself being posted to other units.
That's right.
So where did other people go? Did everybody
go to the battalion or was there? No, other people went to different places. It might have depended on how long you still had to serve. And you might have gone to brigade headquarters, or you might have gone into another unit. I think Tony Sacco went to brigade headquarters. He didn't go to Italy. So it just depended, I think, how old you were and how near demob you were.
Just backtracking slightly about when did people start to be demobbed, you know, from the battalion? About what time was that?
I don't know. I can't really remember.
And it's just a question I should have asked you a little bit earlier, but there was a general election while you were, you know, after the end of the war. Do you have any memories of that? People within the battalion voting in the election? Or
no, sorry to say.
What about people's reaction to the election result with Attlee?
I don't remember much discussion about it at all. It may seem strange, but I really can't.